Good day. Today is Wednesday, 25th March 2026. And at the start of this programme, let me just briefly touch on what is for me personally a rather annoying affair. Over the last few weeks, I have been receiving many emails from many people, many kind and generous people who've taken up time informing me of another channel on YouTube, which is using an AI simulation of myself. And well, what I would say is what I have said in the past about these sort of episodes. Firstly, thank you to everybody who has been emailing me about this. I am extremely grateful. Please be aware that all of your emails have been noted. Secondly, that it is deeply frustrating to me that somebody should be using my identity in order to promote their work. And what little I have seen of this channel makes it quite clear that this AI simulation of myself is mostly saying things and expressing opinions which are quite different from my own. The third thing is obviously to thank everybody who has taken this enormous trouble to write to me about this issue, and I am extremely grateful. Fourthly, please be assured that YouTube are being informed about this. My experience of YouTube is that they do eventually remove channels of this kind, and I expect that they will shortly do it with this one. And lastly, let me repeat again a point which I have made many times when there have been all sorts of fake channels purporting to be me, both before the AI era and since, that the only place you will actually get the real authentic me is on this channel, on the Duran, and on one or two very well-known channels where from time to time I appear as a guest. Any other channel, especially if it is a channel which has a solo speaker, which purports to be myself, other than this one, or the Duran, has absolutely nothing to do with me. Anything, any information, reporting, commentary that appears on that kind of channel has absolutely nothing to do with me. And the person who is, or persons who are engaging in it, are frankly stealing my identity in order to make whatever profit they can from it. So I just wanted to say that. I think it's important to say these things. Thank you again to all of those who have reported this matter to me. Your reports have indeed been noted and acted upon. Well, let's now turn to the programme, and let me say again, as I always do, that to remind you again, rather, to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this video, if you decide that you like what you've heard, you wish to indicate that fact. Now, over the last 24 hours, ever since the President of the United States began talking on Monday about negotiations between Iran and the United States, which, as I have said, certainly never took place. On that topic, I read, by the way, an article by Edward Luce in the Financial Times, in which he made the same point as me, that these negotiations absolutely did not take place. And I noticed that Edward Luce also spoke about the risk the president runs of discrediting himself and his reputation as an even partially factually correct reporter of events when he makes up stories over the weekend about negotiations which never took place in the way that he obviously did. If I noticed that Edward Luce used the same expression from the Vietnam War era, credibility gap, that I do, perhaps it was a coincidence. Perhaps not. Anyway, put all that aside. After all that spinning and false commentary on Monday, the president doubled down yesterday, continued to insist that negotiations were underway, and continues to talk about more negotiations with Iran. And the United States, the administration, has even published a 15-point plan, or I say they've published a 15-point plan. They've been talking about a 15-point plan, which they say they have conveyed to Iran via mediators, either Turkey or Pakistan, or perhaps both Turkey and Pakistan. It's impossible for me to say which. And the US, the administration, Donald Trump, are talking as if this 15-point plan is going to be the basis of the future negotiations. Now, the Iranians, I think absolutely, truthfully, are saying that they know absolutely nothing about any of this. They say that the Americans are negotiating with themselves, that they've never agreed to negotiate with the Americans on any American plan, let alone the 15-point plan that they're now being presented with. That they have made their objectives in the war perfectly clear. They want to see the US bases removed from the Middle East. They want all sanctions immediately lifted, and they want Iran's right to conduct nuclear enrichment on its own territory freely and without restriction, save the sort of restrictions that derive from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, of which, by the way, Iran continues to be a signatory. That remains Iran's official position. And the Iranians, as I will speak shortly, continue to engage in the war. They continue to conduct their own strikes, and they continue to maintain a tight grip on the Strait of Hormuz. And Iranian officials have also been saying that Iran was twice tricked by Donald Trump. On two occasions, in June 2025 and in February 2026, it appeared that negotiations were moving forward successfully. As a result, Iran lowered its guard and exposed itself that way to an American attack. And for that reason, the Iranians this time are not going to let themselves be fooled. They don't believe Trump. They don't believe his good faith or in his good intentions. And, well, they are not interested in negotiations, with him. Now, here I would say that I've seen various different versions, different worded versions of this supposed 15-point plan. And, well, there's also been an extraordinarily cynical comment about the 15-point plan that the Iranians are supposed to have been presented with. And interestingly and importantly, it comes from Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov. And this is the report in TASS, which sets out Russia's view of this 15-point plan. Moscow does not know how reliable reports are regarding an alleged US plan for a settlement in the Middle East. The New York Times reported that the US had sent the Iranian authorities a 15-point plan to end the Middle East conflict. And then we have Peskov's words. No, our Iranian friends have not shared this kind of information with us. We do not know how truthful these reports are. And then he went on to say that in relation to the conflict in Ukraine and to the various American plans about the conflict in Ukraine, to settle the conflict in Ukraine, there were many plans with varying numbers of provisions regarding the Ukrainian settlement. We don't know how reliable they are. We don't know if they correspond to reliability, to reality at all. There is currently such a volume of information, the lion's share of which is an absolute lie, that it is impossible to judge anything unless there is some confirmation from official sources. So that's what Peskov said. So Peskov says that the Russians have been led up the garden path repeatedly with all sorts of 28-point plans, 27-point plans, 15-point plans that the United States has been churning out. It has seen only some of these plans. It's aware of a supposed agreement between the United States and Ukraine, whereby the United States provides security guarantees to Ukraine. The Russians have never seen or been shown this. All that they know is what they read about in the West's newspapers. It seems to them that it is the same situation with this 15-point plan that has been presented to Iran. The Iranians themselves have told the Russians that basically they know nothing about it. And the Russians don't believe in it and have no trust in it either. It seems to me that translated into plain English, that is what Peskov is saying. Now, I have trawled through the various versions of this 15-point plan or alleged 15-point plan that has been floating around the media and the internet. And from what I can see, when you drill it down, it does a number of things. Firstly, it does represent a tactical retreat from the original objective that Donald Trump publicly declared at the start of this military operation against Iran, that objective being, of course, regime change in Iran, the overthrow of the government of Iran, which he has at various times referred to as a terrorist regime. So there is absolutely nothing about that in these various versions of the 15-point plan that I see. On the contrary, the entire plan seems to assume that the existing government of Iran will remain in place. That's the first thing. The second is that earlier variants of American demands made all sorts of demands of Iran to carry out fundamental changes to its domestic economy and political system. Changes so drastic that they would in themselves have represented a change of regime. Well, again, there is nothing of this sort in the 15-point plan or the versions of that plan that I have seen floating around. So, in a sense, there is a tactical retreat. Trump made perfectly clear what he expected to achieve as a result of the ongoing military operation. He seems finally to have had doubts about whether it could be achieved at all. And so he's rode back. But it is only a tactical retreat, because the position he appears to me to have rode back to is basically the same one that Witkoff and Kushner presented to Araxi in the various negotiations that took place before the attack in June 2025 and before the attack in February 2026. And basically, what it amounts to is an end of nuclear enrichment of the territory of Iran. And perhaps even more critically, such extreme restrictions on Iran's ballistic missile program. And here, by the way, I should say that there are special differences in various versions of the 15-point plan on this particular specific topic. Fundamental changes, basically, Iran either accepting such severe limits on its ballistic missiles so that it would lose its own, as it would say, deterrent capability to strike at Israel, or perhaps that it would go even further and beyond that. There are some versions of this 15-point plan which are out there, which speak about Iran essentially dismantling its entire industry that enables it to build ballistic missiles. Anyway, these two things taken together, but in some ways particularly the ballistic missile demand, represents the American demands that were made before the start of the two wars, the one in June and the one we're now currently in. And they, in effect, represent a demand for the unilateral disarmament of Iran. And the Iranians, who are perfectly well aware that Donald Trump's objective is regime change. He has, of course, said that publicly, and who are, of course, perfectly well aware that the Israeli objective is ultimately regime change, and who now have good reasons to believe that despite Saudi Arabia's, MBS's, various protestations of friendship towards Iran, his objective also in Iran is regime change. There are more reports in the US media today that MBS, despite all that is happening, is continuing to insist with apparently growing urgency that the United States must continue the war with Iran. He probably realizes that if the war ends now on anything like Iranian terms, Iran will be in such an overwhelming position of advantage over Saudi Arabia that the imbalance of power will become lopsided, and that this will in effect push Saudi Arabia into a subordinate position in the Middle East. So from his perspective, the urgency of preventing that is now growing, and I think it is entirely possible, despite public denials, that Saudi Arabia and he really are pressing Trump to continue the war until regime change in Iran is now achieved. I'll return to this topic later, perhaps in this video, perhaps in another one. Anyway, the Iranians know all of this. They know that their enemies, the Americans, the Israelis, and probably the Saudis, want regime change in their country. And they undoubtedly understand, just as they understood before the start of the two wars, that if they agree to these proposals, whatever exactly they are, they will simply disarm themselves ahead of the next military round, which will inevitably come. And of course, there are other things in the 15-point plan. Plans to reopen the Strait of Hormuz and to keep it open no matter what happens. Again, why would the Iranians agree to something like that when, from their perspective, control of the Strait of Hormuz is what gives them the decisive advantage over Trump and the United States in this conflict? And of course, the usual package of promises about sanctions being lifted, the US helping Iran with its civilian nuclear program. On the first, Iran also received promises of sanctions relief when it signed the JCPOA, but those were never fully honoured. And on the second, as I very well remember, and as the Iranians probably know, and as their North Korean friends may be reminding them, North Korea also in the 1990s received promises from the United States of assistance with a civil nuclear program if North Korea put a stop to its own nuclear weapons program. And North Korea accepted those promises and for a period of time did put a stop to its nuclear weapons program. Only those promises were never honoured, and there's no reason to believe that they would be honoured in the case of Iran. There's been some discussion about whether the Iranians understand how hostile, how implacably hostile to them the political establishment in the United States basically is. On the Duran, a few days ago, we did a program with Jim Jatras, a former US State Department official, in which Jim Jatras made that very point, that Iran, in its discussions with the United States, needs to understand that the United States is so implacably hostile to itself that negotiations with the United States from anything other than a position of overwhelming strength are basically pointless, because any deal done which leaves the United States in any sort of position of advantage is never in the end going to be honoured. The Iranians undoubtedly do understand this. If you go to the Iranian media, you find statements to this effect there all the time. So, if this is a set of proposals, this is the proposals that Donald Trump is actually placing before the Iranians are going to give them short shrift. They're going to reject them wholesale. It is inconceivable that they would do otherwise. They were already rejecting these proposals before the June and February attacks. The February attack, which is of course still underway, is all but certain to have hardened their position. Now, another factor that is probably making the Iranians particularly sceptical of these proposals is that the United States is apparently also again urging Iran to agree to a ceasefire. A one-month ceasefire to enable the negotiations to get underway. And the Iranians, who are perfectly well aware of the ongoing US military deployments and of the immense pressure the president and his officials are under as a result of Iranian strikes across the Middle East and in Israel, and of the pressure that comes from the surges in energy costs and the Iranian control of the Strait of Hormuz. The Iranians almost certainly sense that the only real purpose of the negotiations is to get the ceasefire, the one-month ceasefire, and that after that month, the United States will resume the attack, only it will do so from a stronger position than the one it is in today. It is exactly the same calculation that the Russians have been making in Ukraine. The Ukrainians, since March of last year, and the Americans and the Europeans for longer, have also been trying to get the Russians to agree to an interim ceasefire, supposedly in order to get negotiations for a final settlement underway. The Russians have repeatedly said no. They repeatedly say that such a ceasefire would for them be a trap, that all that would happen if there were such a ceasefire is that the Western powers and the Ukrainians would use the time to put themselves in a stronger military position, as they have repeatedly done ever since the start of the Ukraine crisis with the Maidan events of February 2016. The Iranians are making the identical calculation. And, well, I doubt that they need it. But Peskov's comment shows that the Russians are indeed in constant communication with the Iranians. And if they are, then I have no doubt that at some level, at least, the Russians are giving the same advice to the Iranians as well. Of course, the Russians do say they want a ceasefire, and that is their publicly stated position, as it is China's position too. But of course, what is said in formal statements may not always correspond with what is being said quietly and in private. And as I said in the past, the Russian diplomatic stance about rejecting a ceasefire and insisting on a final agreement that will satisfy all Russian terms, Istanbul Plus, in other words, is so similar to the approach that Iran is taking that I, for one, can't help but think that there has been at least some discussion between the two countries on this issue. Anyway, in summary, this whole proposal is stillborn, is going to be stillborn. Perhaps, possibly, some discussions between the Iranians and the Americans will take place, though the Iranians don't seem to be keen on engaging in those discussions at all. But if those discussions do take place, the Iranians are certain to say that this 15-point plan is unacceptable. It's simply the same plan that Iran has repeatedly rejected, that there is no way that Iran is going to accept this plan at a time when they sense that the Americans are in a weaker position, and that the idea of a ceasefire is simply not on the table. There has to be a permanent resolution which will guarantee that there is no future attack on Iran again. I should say that I also get the sense that whatever internal divisions existed within Iranian society before the attack on the 28th of February, today Iranian society has consolidated and united behind this position, just as Russian society has consolidated around the position that the Russians themselves have been taking in all discussions for a resolution of the conflict in Ukraine. So there it is. Now, there is only one thing about all of this talk of negotiations, which does perhaps give some reason to hope that in time events might move forward to an actual negotiated resolution. I'm not saying what that resolution will be. I'm saying that there is a change on the American side, which might, if used properly, open up a way forward. Because the president has finally conceded that there have to be changes to the negotiating team. So reports say that the Iranians have made absolutely clear that whatever happens going forward, two people that they're not prepared to meet with and negotiate with again are Witkoff and Kushner. They feel that they were badly deceived by those two in June of last year and in February of this year, that both of them made promises of negotiations and appeared to be engaging in negotiations, and that those negotiations, as it turns out, were not being conducted in good faith by them. And for my part, I have in many programmes spoken about the inadequacy of both Witkoff and Kushner to conduct negotiations at this level. Neither man has a background in high-level diplomatic negotiations. Anyway, there are reports, in fact the president himself has said, that henceforth the negotiations with Iran will be conducted by the Vice President, J.D. Vance, by the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, though he still apparently hopes that Witkoff might play a role. Now, that does represent an improvement in the American negotiating team. Vance has as little experience and background in international negotiations as Witkoff and Kushner do. He's never been a foreign services officer or a diplomat or anything of that kind. But I do get the sense that he's a much more careful and thorough man. And, well, there's been many, many reports saying that he has been extremely sceptical, in fact, straightforwardly opposed to the entire conflict that we are now seeing. And over and above and beyond that, Vance, as vice president, can bring to any negotiation his own team, who are officials of the US government. As vice president, he has his own national security advisor, he has his own national security team. He would be in a much better position, or so it seems to me, to conduct negotiations at this level. Marco Rubio is the Secretary of State. He has the support of the State Department of bureaucracy. He also, as Donald Trump's National Security Advisor, has the support of the National Security Council's bureaucracy. And as a US senator, he has an extensive, if deeply neocon background in foreign policy matters. I noticed that some media reports are now trying to place Rubio amongst the skeptics in terms of this conflict with Iran. I am myself skeptical about that, given Rubio's past. But anyway, nonetheless, if only because he is Secretary of State, a National Security Advisor, with a sort of foreign policy background and a bureaucracy to call upon, having Rubio as well as Vance engage Araghchi in negotiations would represent a very significant improvement over this bizarre amateur so-called negotiation that we have seen up to now, both between the Americans and the Russians, and by the way, and of course, between the Americans and the Iranians. Anyway, there it is. Now, for Vance and for Rubio to be able to do their work, they do need at some point to have real meetings with the Iranians, either one-to-one, face-to-face, or via intermediaries. I'm going to say this again. I've said this in previous programs. Turkey and Pakistan can no doubt play a role, but they do not have much leverage over Iran. They do not have the ability also to give Iran the kind of advice that would be needed in order to get a negotiation track running. Russia does. And I do think that it would make much more sense for the Americans to start talking to the Russians about this, rather than to spend too much time talking to the Pakistanis and the Turks. On the topic of Turkey, by the way, I should say that the country is once again in an economic crisis. It has been particularly affected by the surges in energy costs and by the falling levels of energy in global markets. Turkey imported much of its energy from Iran, which makes total sense given that the two countries are neighbours. The result is that this has deepened Turkey's perennial current account problems. The country runs both budget and trade deficits, and has basically done so throughout the Erdogan era. The result is that there is a run on the Turkish currency. The result is that the Turkish Central Bank is having to take steps to support the Turkish currency. The result is that there's talk that the Central Bank is going to have to draw on Turkey's extensive, but far from limitless, gold reserves. Anybody familiar with Turkish economic history during the Erdogan era will be familiar with all of this. Anyway, just saying, it's just an aside. That's what I wanted to say about this. Now, as to these negotiations, again, I would repeat the point I made in my program yesterday, rather than wasting time over negotiations, the negotiations which, as the Iranians are saying, are basically negotiations between the United States and itself, not really with Iran at all. It's important to focus instead on military developments. The Iranians continue to hold a tight grip on the Strait of Hormuz. The Iranian Foreign Minister, Abbas Araghchi, had a very interesting telephone conversation with the Chinese Foreign Minister, Wang Yi. Araghchi assured Wang Yi that the Strait of Hormuz is not closed to shipping, that ships can pass through the Strait of Hormuz, provided they are ships carrying energy products to countries that are not aligned with Iran's enemies, the United States and Israel. The Chinese, for their part, Wang Yi, for his part, assured Iran of China's continued support. But anyway, there is that. The Iranians continue to conduct their missile and drone strikes across the Middle East. They were pounding Israel again. It's very difficult for me to assess what is going on there. I saw in one of Seymour Hersh's most recent articles, probably his most recent one, that over the course of one particular missile strike on Israel, 6 million out of Israel's 11 million population were having to hide in shelters, which again does rather suggest that Iranian missiles are indeed coming through. The caveat is that I'm sorry to say this, but I'm far from convinced that the information that Seymour Hersh is publishing on this or any other issue is as reliable anymore as it once used to be. Just saying. Anyway, the Iranians continue to pound military facilities. The United States continues and Israel continue to conduct missile and bomb strikes on Iran. Officials in both Israel and the United States have confirmed the Israeli strikes on Iran's Caspian Sea ports. I discussed these in a program I made some days ago. I said that it looked to me as if those strikes were intended to obstruct supplies sent to Iran across the Caspian Sea by ship from Russia. And these reports, which, by the way, have also been published in the British media, confirm that the attacks on the Caspian Sea ports are indeed intended to prevent supplies reaching Iran from Russia. This is the obvious conclusion, and that does seem to be the case. And by the way, it is indirect confirmation that Iran is indeed receiving supplies and assistance from Russia. For the record, I don't believe that attacks on the Caspian Sea ports can stop the traffic entirely, especially as it appears that the strikes are being carried out from very long distances. The missiles involved are certainly not hypersonic or anything like that. The Russians and the Iranians probably get significant advance notice of them. And, well, anyway, destroying ships or even damaging ships, as the Americans discovered during the Vietnam War when they bombed the Vietnamese port city of Haiphong repeatedly Well, those kind of attacks are very difficult. Besides, the Russians and the Iranians have another route through which supplies can be sent, which is by land from Tajikistan and through the other Central Asian republics. Just saying. So, anyway, the war goes on. The Strait of Hormuz continues to remain closed. Trump's announcement of his 15-point plan and of his negotiating team and the talk of negotiations again briefly reassured global energy markets, causing the price of energy to fall. The Iranians are incredibly cynical about this. They're saying that this is simply that these announcements from Trump are mostly intended to bring about precisely these falls in energy prices. And on that, the Iranians, by the way, are probably right, or at least partially right. But anyway, all of that is going on. But perhaps the most interesting thing is that we still continue to receive information about military buildups, an American military buildup in the Middle East. And here I'm going to say that I've received a lot of information from three sources. One is an open source, Larry Johnson, Sonar 21. He has also looked at the movement of troops from the United States. And interestingly, he has come to a different view about the nature of the forces that the United States is concentrating in the Middle East than the ones that the sources that I discussed in my program yesterday. Instead of four US Army divisions, Larry Johnson sees two US Marine units. About those, of course, there is no doubt. The 82nd Airborne Division and various other more specialized light forces that are also being sent to the Middle East. US Army Rangers, various special forces units, things of that kind. And here I'm going to say straight away that on these matters, I consider Larry Johnson to be both definitive and authoritative. In other words, it looks as if, for the moment at least, the US military deployments take, shall we say, a lighter form than I discussed in my program yesterday. But above Larry Johnson's very interesting commentary, I have also received two further emails from two entirely different sources. One of them is someone that I regularly receive advice from. The other is a new source. I say a source, somebody who's well informed about these things. Anyway, this particular person is an expert specifically on the 82nd Airborne Division, about which he is exceptionally well informed, and has a proper and detailed understanding. I think that is all I can say, other than that he is not an officer, a serving officer in this division, but in all other respects, and I know his background, he is somebody who is extremely well informed. Of course, not just about this division, about many divisions and other military units in the US military. But anyway, he has provided me, as the other source has also done, a great deal of information about the overall military buildup that is taking place and about the role of the 82nd Airborne Division in it. And the interesting and important fact is that what the two sources say exactly dovetails, which lends weight to what, of course, they're both saying. Anyway, the point is that the, and I'm going to summarise very briefly, the 82nd Airborne Division is an extremely well-trained unit. It's specifically geared towards carrying out certain roles. Amongst these roles is the capture of what might be described as bridgeheads. And capturing bridgeheads is normally accompanied with plans for insertion of more heavy units, if you like, in order to consolidate control. Now, this is only a very summary description of what these two sources are saying. But basically, I think I've summarised it accurately. Now, there's now said to be 3,000 men from the 82nd Airborne Division in the Middle East. And before long, the division could be brought into operation. Both sources say that this could be done relatively quickly. The nature of the 82nd Airborne Division is that it is extremely experienced and has the ability to plan and prepare these operations very fast. So we are not looking at months of time before it goes into action. But the second source, perhaps more than the first one, nonetheless, also spoke about a very high-risk operation. Indeed, an operation in which what is ultimately a light infantry force is going to be thrown into battle, potentially against an enormous country with very extensive armed forces, with no clear guarantee of any follow-up to enable it to fulfil whatever objective it's been tasked with. As to what that objective is, by the way, neither source says. They don't have access to that kind of information. Now, reading all of this and reading various other reports of this kind, I'm going to say that it did bring back to mind a battle that took place in the early 1950s in a place in Vietnam called Dien Bien Phu. During the conflict, the colonial conflict between the French and the Vietnamese, led by the Vietnamese Communist Party, who were seeking independence from France, the French gambled on a high-risk operation of using airborne forces, paratroopers, to seize positions well behind Vietnamese lines in the expectation that France would have total air superiority and would be able to keep the paratroopers supplied by air, and that this operation would somehow turn the balance of the war. What the French quickly discovered is that the organisation and willpower and capability of the Vietnamese was far greater than they expected or imagined. The Vietnamese responded rapidly. The French force was quickly surrounded and was shelled into submission by the Vietnamese, triggering a catastrophic defeat, which ultimately brought about the defeat of France in the wars in Vietnam and Indochina. Now, in my childhood and early youth, Dien Bien Phu was a very vivid memory. I don't hear it talked about very much anymore. Perhaps, given that what possibly is being planned here with the 82nd Airborne Division. He's not so different from Tien Bien Phu. It might be a good idea for some American planners to revisit what happened in that battle. Again, it might avoid a potential disaster, which it seems to me might be looming over the horizon. Now, anyway, that's what I want to say about the conflict between Iran and Israel and the United States today. Just one very last point, which is that whatever the president does, it seems to me that he is now running out of time. He seems to be at least trying to get some kind of dialogue with the Iranians back on track, and he clearly wants a ceasefire. I don't believe that there is any good faith behind it, and I don't see why the Iranians would agree. But the fact that he's doing this at all shows that he's not been able to fulfill his original objective when he started this operation, which is regime change. And he needs to find a way of getting the Strait of Hormuz open again and of getting supplies of energy moving again. And he's trying to do that, or at least is making motions towards trying to do that by offering Iran negotiations. But if the Iranians don't take the bait, which I hardly think they will, then the time imperative for the president remains in place. He still needs to get the Strait of Hormuz open. Otherwise, energy prices are going to surge. There are more and more reports of energy rationing and problems around the world. I read that in the Philippines, they're now having to cancel commercial flights because of shortages of aviation fuel. There's growing worries about shortages of fertilizer. The Carnegie Endowment, by the way, has published a long report saying that in order to avoid starvation, global famine, it is now imperative, in effect, to release unsanctioned, in effect, trade in Russian fertilizer. The Russians are able to fill the gaps, but of course they're not able to do so at the moment, or at least the trade to do so at the moment is still being disrupted by the sanctions. So anyway, the president still has to face these problems. If he cannot get the Iranians to agree to a ceasefire using the ruse of negotiations, he has to find some other way to get the Strait of Hormuz reopened and an end to hostilities in the Middle East. Capitulating to Iranian demands would, of course, be politically impossible. It could conceivably even set up the president for impeachment after the congressional elections in November. So what does he do? And, well, he does have these military units moving into place. I've given my warning about Tien Bien Phu. But a desperate man, a man who is clearly now subject to spasms of panic, as we saw with his 48-hour ultimatum, is capable of reckless and extraordinary things. And, well, there has to be a possibility that whatever warnings he is given about the risks he is going to take not just for himself and the global economy, but for the soldiers of whom he is commander in chief, that he will nonetheless embrace that risk because he feels he has no other political choice but to do so. Well, if we do get into those sort of scenarios, then I think that those within the administration who are trying to urge counsels of reason and sanity are going to have both their work cut out, but particularly high responsibility to try to block or prevent what could be incredibly dangerous decisions. Well, let me now move to that other conflict, the conflict in Ukraine. Now, one of the things that I have been a little puzzled about over the course of the winter is that something that all the reports coming out of both Russia and Ukraine said was going to happen had not happened. And that was the 1,000 drone a night raids across Ukraine. Throughout the summer and early autumn of 2025, we saw the Russians cranking up use of their Garand drones over Ukraine. There were nights when up to 800 drones were in the sky at one and the same time. There were multiple reports that production of drones, of these drones in Russia, was reaching sky-high levels. And there were lots of expectations, including in Ukraine itself, that over the course of the winter, the Russians would be laying aerial siege to Ukraine by launching against Ukraine 1,000 drone raids a night at regular intervals. Well, that never happened. In fact, rather surprisingly, at least surprisingly to me, over the course of the winter, the number of drones that the Russians launched on any particular night actually reduced. The Russians still continue to launch hundreds of drones at Ukraine. The drones themselves began to become increasingly sophisticated and complex. Some of them had jet engines, others of them were clearly guided. Many of them were flying much closer to the ground. There were differences in warheads. Some of them carried air-to-air missiles. But we never saw the 1,000 a night drones that, well, I won't say they were promised, but concerning which the warnings proliferated. Well, we did last night. In fact, not just over last night, the course of last night, but over an extended period, the Russians conducted the first massive drone attack, with the drones coming in waves, some during the night, some during daylight. And by some estimates, over 1,100 drones, Garand drones of various types, took part in the raid. And alongside some of these drones, there were missiles. The Russians have become extremely skilled at combining drones and missiles and different types of missiles in their strikes. And, well, in the early hours, as the first part of the attack was taking place, the Ukrainians were again making claims about their extraordinary success in shooting down most of the drones, or nearly all of the drones that were being launched. This was part of the attack, the first part of the attack that took place in night time, so that it was difficult or more difficult to debunk the Ukrainian claims. But then one senses, to the horror of the Ukrainians, the attack continued into daylight. The drones continued to come in almost unending numbers. And in daylight, it was far more difficult to hide the truth that most of the drones were getting through. Perhaps the most dramatic footage that I've seen from this massive strike is of a Geran drone crashing in to a building in Lvov in western Ukraine. Very unclear, very uncertain what it was exactly that the Russians were targeting in this building, but clearly the building was being targeted for some reason. And apparently, and though I haven't been able to make a complete picture of what is happening, it does seem as if the drone attack did do very substantial damage across Ukraine, and I suspect the missile strikes did so also. Now, of course, that begs the question of why the Russians have waited until now. It may be that production has been less fast than the Russians intended. Or it could be, and I think this is a real possibility, that the Russians quietly transferred a proportion of the drones they were producing to Iran, and that many of the Shahed drones that we see across the Middle East originate from either Russian factories or perhaps more plausibly from Russian-controlled factories, perhaps in places like Tajikistan. Just saying. There is a further possibility, and that is that there are logistics at play, that the Russians increased the volumes of their drones, the drone output, wanted to build up massive stockpiles, and that makes total sense, by the way. The Russians would want to keep a big reserve of drones ready so that they can continue to conduct assaults regardless of any production stops. And of course, if they need to surge, say, use 2,000 drones in a night, then they need to have a reserve in order to enable them to do that. There are further factors as well, which is that, of course, these are relatively new weapons. And it may be that though the Russians had huge numbers of drones, they may have lacked the facilities, the launchers, to launch over 1,000 of these drones at one and the same time. One should never underestimate these sort of things. They never get discussed, but the possibility that there was a hold up because of shortages of launchers is absolutely not to be discounted. It is the sort of thing that does take place in the real world, and it may have taken some weeks and months to get all of those problems sorted out. There might be weather issues. It might be that the Russians decided that at this relatively early stage, it would be far more difficult to coordinate the movement of 1,000 drones in the difficult winter conditions with the high winds and the snow and all of that, so that they needed brighter, clearer, sunnier, warmer weather in order to do it. Who knows? There is a further, somewhat intriguing possibility, though it is not one I'm going to push very hard. The day before yesterday, the Russians launched their first a rocket from their space center in Plesetsk above the Arctic Circle, which placed into orbit 16 satellites of the, I believe it's called Rusvet system. Now, Rusvet is Russia's analog to the Starlink system. The Russians have been working on it for some years, since before the pandemic, in fact. They carried out tests on its components in 2023 and then again 2024. But these are the first of these satellites that have actually entered into orbit. And the Russian objective is to launch, is to have an array of 250 of these satellites operating next year, with up to 900 satellites forming complete global coverage by some point in the early 2030s. Now, I should say that is a fraction of the 10,000 Starlink satellites that Elon Musk's Starlink system uses. But the Russians say that because their satellites operate at higher orbits than Elon Musk's, they need fewer satellites, far fewer satellites than Musk's Starlink system does. I'm not going to discuss the technical aspects of this, which is well outside my scope of knowledge, whether that is true or whether it is not. Who knows? I'm not able to say. Now, a couple of weeks ago, the Russians were using Starlink to guide some of their Geran drones, which were conducting attacks in western Ukraine. And then, as everyone knows, Elon Musk and Starlink made drastic changes to the Starlink system, so that the result was that became impossible. It became impossible for the Russians to piggyback on Starlink in the way that they had been doing in order to conduct attacks deep inside Ukraine. I wonder whether that was a test run and whether the Russians actually were using the Starlink to familiarize themselves with the way a system of this kind could be used in anticipation of the first satellites of the Rusvet array coming into service. Now, it is important to say at this point that this launch of the 16 Rusvet satellites, even if they are mostly focused on providing coverage to the Russian military forces in the special military operation, cannot have been used for this massive 1,000 drone strike that we have seen. The satellites are not yet in operation. At the time when the strike took place, they were still moving into their positions, though apparently they're all operating properly. And the expectation is that in the next few hours, that is what they will do. But they weren't operating at the time when, as I said, this big strike took place. Could it be, however, that there is some correlation of timing here? The Russians have now got the first array of this satellite system up in the sky. This is the moment to test the drone strikes, including drone strikes deep into western Ukraine. The two systems have not yet been mated or combined with each other, but the drone operators have already gained experience on the Starlink system in the earlier drone strikes that took place a few weeks ago. And could it be that perhaps in a few weeks, or perhaps more realistically months' time, we are finally going to see these 1,000 Geran drone raids take place with the drones operated and guided by the Rusvet system in the same way that the Ukrainians allegedly use the Starlink system to control their drones? Just guess. Anyway, whatever. The strike did apparently do significant damage on Ukraine. Again, I'm not in a position to give a detailed assessment. We must wait for that for the next couple of days. Elsewhere, it seems that the big battle now, the two big battles, are the battles that are taking place around Orekhov, where the Russians are advancing, the even bigger battle that is taking place in Konstantinovka. And as I said, I think that the battle for Konstantinovka is indeed past its tipping point. And I noticed that Radovka again is now much more explicitly talking about Ukrainian troops in Konstantinovka being in effect in a cauldron type situation. And the Russian advances near Slavyansk in the north, where, as Scott of Calibrated particularly likes to explain, and by the way, Stanislav Krapivnik too, the Russians are focusing on capturing the high ground. Meanwhile, Zelensky is complaining that the Russians are showing no interest in the negotiations anymore. There was a meeting between Witkoff and the Ukrainian negotiators, Witkoff and Kushner, the Ukrainian negotiators. The Russians stayed away. According to the Ukrainians, the Americans again told the Ukrainians that in order to break the logjam in the negotiations, the Ukrainians must withdraw from Donbass. This is the Russian demand. Zelensky is complaining that the Russians are constantly saying now, and I've discussed this in previous programs, that the Russians are going to stick to the agreement that was reached between Putin and Trump in Anchorage. And the one thing that we can say with some confidence about that agreement is that it required a Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass. Anyway, the Russians are sticking to this position. Zelensky is bitterly complaining about it. He says that the result is that the negotiations go round and round in circles. The Russians won't budge. The Americans tell the Ukrainians that they've done all they can with the Russians. The only way that the logjam can be broken is if the Ukrainians withdraw from Donbass, which might finally move the negotiation forward. And the Ukrainians themselves respond that that is the one thing they simply will not do, that they cannot give up more of that land. And besides, their great fortified lines are in Donbass. And if they withdrew from Donbass, they would lose them. I've discussed in many places these negotiations. I made the point that Putin himself comes under significant criticism including within Russia, for having engaged in the negotiations at all. But the key point, the essential point, is that Putin has never made any substantive concessions in the negotiations. And we can see that, and the Ukrainians have no choice but to realise that too. And their hopes of getting some kind of ceasefire are withering away, just as their hopes of unending military and financial support from the West under the pressure of the crisis with Iran is dwindling away too. Meanwhile, in Europe, we're starting to see more and more problems for Ukraine. Viktor Orban, who's facing elections in a few weeks, has now announced that Hungary will stop supplying gas to Ukraine in light of Ukraine's failure to allow oil to be supplied to Hungary through the Druzhba pipeline. In Denmark, Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen, one of the most fervid supporters of Ukraine in Europe, an individual who has an almost fanatical position on Ukraine and Russia, despite all kinds of claims and assertions that were floating around just a few weeks ago, that Frederiksen was experiencing a surge of popularity because of the strong position she took against Donald Trump over Greenland. Anyway, there's been parliamentary elections in Denmark. Frederiksen's Social Democrats have polled the worst result they have had for 100 years. They're down to just 22%, which is catastrophic for what has historically been the dominant party in Danish politics for many, many decades. Frederiksen has now been forced to resign. I've said this many times. Anti-Russian policies and rhetoric may be massively popular within the European elite or the Western elite, but they lose elections not because voters particularly like Russia, but because they find the obsession with Russia on the part of their leaders absurd and see it as a sign that their leaders are not ultimately interested in them. So Zelensky has lost another key ally, and even Ursula is now admitting that with the energy crisis, the European Union may have to postpone its ban on imports of Russian oil. The Russians watch and wait. It's often said that he who waits eventually gets all he wants. It must be feeling a little bit like that in Moscow now. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work if you wish via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Don't forget to check out our Substack page. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.